Let's bring in the professor, Ron Wotus. How do you like this matchup today?
Yeah, it should be a good matchup. A lot of experience on the mound, two completely different types of pitchers, and just a knuckleballer in general. We don't see him very often, you know, and when you do, it's something really a lot different than you're used to hitting. And so we'll see how our guys react to it. It's hard to find the guys that have faced a lot of knuckleballers and, yes. and who's going to have the best at bat against the knuckleballer, because it's something that's a little more difficult to prepare for.
Boy, interesting you say that. I'll bring it up. As you mentioned, Ruggiano 4-for-8 with a homer off of him. Posey 2-for-12. Nunez 1-for-5. Moore 7-for-34. Hundley 2-for-9. Hill 2-for-5. Gorky's 2-for-7 with a homer. Craw 0-for-9 and Belt 1-for-5 with a homer.
Yeah.
So not a lot of experience.
No.
Really, the only one is Morrison. He wouldn't really get some action today with the most at-bats against Dickey.
Right, right. Well, the one that jumps out at you is Ruggiano. And, you know, I think today, as a staff, we'd probably put a little more credence into the numbers against the knuckleballer because they are so completely different. And you know, you try to find the right guy. I mean, over the years, you know, you've seen hitters that haven't faced a knuckleballer and, they have no success against them. So we'll see, you know, within reason. I'm sure we'll look at those numbers and think, you know, who's their best opportunity today. And, you know, I think there's a good chance Ruggiano will be in there.
Yeah, very good. I'm glad we took a look at this. The professor is with us. So a lot of people listen to our show, obviously, and are not in tune with exactly the nuances of baseball. And that's why we enjoy doing this for everybody. But describe a knuckleball a little bit, you know, sort of how you... We need Mark Gardner in here to explain how to throw it. But he threw a curveball. He didn't know anything about knuckleballs. But, you know, explain the knuckleball a little bit. And as a hitter, how do you approach it?
Well, you know, that's what makes it so difficult. I mean, the knuckleball moves around like a butterfly, you know, obviously. And the speed of the pitch is a lot slower, which... there in itself is a lot different for the hitters. They're not used to facing a ball, you know, pitch 70 miles an hour. They're used to, and this guy throws it pretty hard.
Yes,
his knuckleball is a little bit different, but they're very, very unpredictable. You know, we watch video, we face pitchers all the time. We got curveballs, some have more bite than others, or the sinker, you know, the ball sinks a little bit. Whatever the case may be, you face that all the time. But a knuckleballer, they're unpredictable. The ball moves in many different directions. It darts and it dives and it's harder to use your imagination and know where it's going to go. Now, in general, Dickey throws a ball a little bit harder and it does have some late movement to it. And that's what makes it so difficult, that late movement, and you're not sure how much or how far it will move on each pitch. It's inconsistent.
Well, he does throw it harder, and he's more of a pitcher, and he developed a knuckleball later in life. I remember when he did develop it. But there's the old saying, when it's high, let it fly, and
yep.
low, let it go. I yep. always remember that about the knuckleball. And when I was a kid growing up, we had Hoyt Wilhelm, who was a great knuckleballer, and Eddie Fisher, who was not the singer, but he pitched for the San Francisco Giants. And, of course, Phil Niekro came in, and
right.
Tom Candiotti and people like that. Joe Niekro. Did you ever hit against a knuckleball?
Yeah. Was it Russ Springer in
yeah.
the minor leagues?
Yeah.
He was
yeah.
with the Angels, pitched in the big leagues for quite a while. Faced him a few times, yeah.
How'd you hit it?
I don't remember. I'm sitting here coaching, so maybe it wasn't very good.
Okay.
But you know, your point about, you know, you see it up, you want to go ahead and take the swing, and, you know, if it's low, let it go. You know, that's great advice. That is great advice on the knuckleball. And what makes it even more difficult with a guy like Dickey is what frustrates you as a hitter. You know, you're looking for the knuckleball, and then he sneaks that darn fastball in there
yeah.
once in a while, and it looks
yeah.
like it's 95 miles an hour.
Yeah.
So they really do mess with your timing. You would say, oh, just sit on a fastball. Well, you don't get one. Then all of a sudden, out of the blue, he throws a fastball and you take it because you're just yeah. not ready for it.
Yeah, no, good point. As I said, as a kid, I always thought the knuckleball, you threw with your knuckles. You know, what did I know? You know, but you don't do that. they, you know, have the nail file, and some have had the nail file in their back pocket, and of course they file the ball down as well.
Right.
But I guess you throw with your fingertips. So for anyone who's listening, if they're knuckleball, I think that's the way you throw it.
Yeah, most of the guys that I've seen is with their fingertips, you know, and I haven't been that involved with looking at the different guys, you know, throw the knuckleball, and how their grips may vary, but the fingertips, I think, is the standard grip. We had one knuckleballer here, of course, he wasn't a pitcher, and that was Lance Niekro, who could throw a pretty good knuckleball, and he grabbed it with the fingertips.
Now, where did he learn that from?
Yeah, I have no idea. We'll have to research that.
His uncle and his father,
yes,
threw a pretty good knuckleball. Of course, Joe Niekro and Phil Niekro. Well, why don't people run on this? Now, Hoyt Wilhelm was a closer for the New York Giants. And Hoyt Wilhelm hit a home run his first at bat, one of his great records. But Hoyt Wilhelm had a long career, played until 48 years old. And he was a closer. He was a closer for the New York Giants. He was a closer for the Orioles, a closer for the White Sox. You'd think with all the pass balls, why don't you run on him more?
Right.
What about the pass balls? That's how Cliff Johnson got his nickname of Bird Dog.
Right.
He used to be chasing the ball all the time.
Yeah. Well, you know, those catchers wear those extra large gloves to catch the knuckleballers because it's difficult to catch alone. And as you said, the ball could be on the loose. You know, the ball darts and dives. A catcher has a hard time. You know, some catchers have a real difficult time. Most of these knuckleballers have a specific catcher that catches him, because it's so difficult to catch, and they're used to doing it. But in Dickey's case, he's extremely fast to the plate. I mean, his release times, by the time he makes his first move and the ball gets to plate, it's like 1-1 to the plate, 1-15. So, you know, to your point where it's difficult to catch, you're really taking chances, and sometimes you will, you know, because it is hard to catch and hard to throw. I bet you if you asked Buster Posey or Nick Hundley catching a knuckleballer, it's difficult to throw a runner out because just catching the ball is the difficult part of it. But he's so quick to the plate, if they do handle the pitch, you're not going to have much of an opportunity to steal the base. So I imagine, you know, we'll be ready for balls in the dirt, balls that get by the catcher or kick away, and I'm sure we'll take a chance here and there with a guy with speed. We'll take a chance to try to steal a base.
Yeah, I think so. Well, let's see how it goes. All right, a little inside baseball to start the show off this morning. Ty Block was excellent last night. In Chicago, he had a big game against the Cubs as well, but he had one defensive play that I really liked. When he got behind Almora, who took the big turn around first base, and they threw behind him, and he got Almora pretty good. Now, Almora is saying, well, I'm going to go halfway to second because there's nobody behind me. I got Belt in front of me. I'm looking at him. But Block got there. Is that a standard play?
Yeah, well, Ty Block, first of all, is a complete pitcher. You know, he's a guy, we're seeing what he's doing, you know, on the mound as far as pitching, but he fields his position extremely well. He can hold runners. He can run pickoff plays. He does all those things to help himself out, win a ball game. And one big part of that is backing up bases and being in the right place. And exactly right. When he saw the batter, he had nowhere else to go, take that big turn, that ball down the right field line. He made his way over to first base, and it was a big play in a close game. And, you know, you want guys on the field that are in the moment and are looking to do anything they can to help the team win. And backing up bases and being in position early is a big part of it.
Is it fair to say that on every play in baseball, anytime a ball is in play, if you're on the field, you should be doing something? I don't care who you are.
Absolutely. You know, you learn these things when you first get into the game. You know, you always have somewhere to go. And I like to use the term with our guys. If you get caught watching a play, or if you get caught spectating, because, you know, you're in the moment of the game, a guy hits a ball in the gap, let's say a middle infielder, and you're hoping the guy catches it, and you get caught spectating on the play instead of getting yourself into good relay position. You know, get to your spot early, so when the play does come your way, you're not in a rush to get there. Now you're in position early. You can peek behind you, see where the runners are going, and the game slows down. When you get caught spectating and you get into position late, or you take for granted that the play is going to develop your way and you don't get into position, that's when you have problems. So Ty did a great job doing what he's trained to do is to get over there and make that play.
Yeah, excellent play. You're right. And look, he hits. Come on, the guy hits. He got a big two out hit last night.
I hope Bum's not listening because Bum obviously is a tremendous hitter with tremendous power. Yeah. But Ty Block is a hitter. I mean, he can move the ball around. Look, when you hit Kershaw and you hit the fastballs that he's hitting, and I would think he's going to hit breaking balls too. He has that type of approach, more of a line drive, put the bat head on the ball, contact type swing.
Who's the best hitting pitcher? Let's put Bumgarner aside for a second. That you played with or saw, maybe a pitcher that stands out to you.
Well, off the top of my head, it's difficult. I mean, watching Bum all these years, that's what really, sticks in the forefront of my mind. But, we had a guy with Pittsburgh, Don Robinson.
The caveman,
who used to hit the long ball as well. And he was so much into this, he would count them. I think one season, he counted how many home runs he hit in batting practice. So he kept a running total for the whole season. How many he hit in batting practice. He loved to hit, and he tried to hit for the fences as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, I met him down in Bradenton where he lives.
Sure,
yeah. He's a very nice man. Don. He was pitched out here with the Giants in 89. He was part of the World Series.
Yes, he was. Yes, he was. I played with him in Pittsburgh. Of course, then he came over here, and a nice man, nice man.
Yeah, very nice. Joe Maddon, you got your fill of the Cubs. As Dwayne said, after 4 days, you'll be sick of seeing the Cubs, so you got your fill of them. But then he went on a road trip to Los Angeles, and, of course, the Cubs, they're the World Series champions. We can touch on this a little bit. Sort of the lethargy of getting it going the next year, and then the Cubs now, even though they took 3 or 4 from the Giants, they've got, I think, 5 singles in 2 days against the Dodgers, and they face Kershaw today. So who knows what's going on with them. But he does these theme trips, and, we've seen this for years. And he relates to younger players. He's trying to do that. And he's got him dressed up in the 70s. I don't know if you saw any of the pictures of it.
I didn't see the pictures, but I've heard of the trip.
What do you think of stuff like that? Do you guys ever think, all right, let's put Bumgarner in, an Elvis Presley outfit or something? do you guys ever think of that? It's all bonding and, the team stuff.
Yeah, well, that's going to be difficult to get Bumgarner and Elvis Presley costume. But to your point, to each his own. Every manager runs his team differently. And I think it's well documented with Joe that he's had a lot of fun with this, and I do believe that players today respond to different things than they did in our culture when we grew up, that was more business-like and serious approach. And, I think keeping it light is a good thing. Whatever it is, Joe likes to do it with these theme trips. I think if you probably asked everybody on the team, I'm sure there's a lot of guys that like it, and I'm sure there's a lot of guys that don't like it, but they're on board for the good of the team, and I think they get a lot of fun out of that. I mean, to your point, their clubhouse alone has a mirror ball and a theme room in the clubhouse for them to dance or party after a win. So it's at a whole different level with them. Our guys and teams that I've been around, they find their fun niches, the things that they do. They have their little things, but I don't think we've ever taken it to that degree. But mostly the players will evolve into what they like to do and how they have their fun.
Yeah, I remember Frank Robinson, by the way, the Cleveland Indians unveiled a statue to Frank, and he's going to be honored here in September as well for his contribution to baseball, the first African-American manager. But I remember when he came to the Orioles, and he was traded from Cincinnati in December of 65, they said he was an old 31. And, of course, he came in 66 and won the Triple Crown for the Orioles and went on to just a tremendous career. But what he did for that team, he brought that team together. And I never forget it, the Kangaroo Court, and I said this yesterday during the show, he would sit there, I think, with a mop on his head, that kind of stuff. And, it sounds crazy for grown men playing a kid's game. As Roy Campanella said, you have to be a man to play, but you got to have a lot of little kid inside of you to make it happen. So Kangaroo Court, is that a thing of the past? We're not trying to single kangaroos out here.
Yeah, no, nothing against a kangaroo, but, when I was drafted, we had it almost every year coming up with the Pirates. We had Kangaroo Court on almost every level. And, you know, it was a way to teach the game. You know, you'd get fined, for, you know, not moving the guy, not getting the guy in from third with less than two outs. But then you would get fined for other things, embarrassing the club, you know, bonehead plays or great play. Maybe you'd get some money back. And that was a way to enforce the game. I think that came into play, the way to enforce the things of the game, you know, how to play the game on the field, but it evolves also into a lot more than that. You know, things off the field and embarrassment of the club, and guys yeah. have taken it to another level. So it was a popular thing. I don't think it's around anymore. I think the last guy that I know that did it, I don't know if it was Kangaroo Court, but wasn't it Pete McCannon with the Phillies instituted a fine system for execution on the field? And I'm not sure if he took it to the Kangaroo Court level or not, but we've done it here over the years, yeah. and it usually is a lot of fun when you got guys on board doing that type of thing.
Yeah, so I bring it up because you were the team now that struggles a little bit. You're 21-30. The third mark is coming up after the Tuesday game. Will be number 54. How do you keep the camaraderie going in the clubhouse? Well, what do you do to keep the vibe positive? Because those are ways of, you know, bonding and keeping people together.
Yeah, as I said, I think the players really evolve into their little routines and niches that they like to do as a group. And if you talk to some of the players on this club, I'm sure they could give you many examples of, you know, the little rituals. I know we have a lot of music in the clubhouse. You know, Craw gets the music going, and
okay.
Hunter
He's
Pence.
The one. Okay.
Yeah, well, and Hunter Pence does some things. So, I mean, you know, the biggest thing for us as a club is to understand, you know, what is in the past is in the past. And today's a new day, like any job, and we try to come in with a positive outlook, you know, encouragement, keep these guys up, that today's the day that's going to change. Yeah. So you have to have a good attitude. I think when things are going bad, you know, you can't point out all the things that are going bad. You have to stay on the positive side and expect things are going to turn for you, and coach in that manner to encourage these guys and get things going back in the right track. And it will. It's, you know, baseball's like that. Things are bad for a few days and it'll turn. You just have to believe it.
Well, it's funny. Last night on the show, I kind of got into it a little bit for everyone who was listening on the way home. And I said this, and I'll just get your reaction to it. But you look at Colorado, they're 18-8 on the road. All right. You look at Arizona, they're 21-8 at home. The Dodgers, 20-8 at home. Now, these are percentages like 70%, 75%. They're tremendous percentages. And you know, last year, the start the Giants got off to, best start in baseball. Things equal out. They come back to the mean. So my point last night to talk to people and get your thought on it, just worry about yourself, because these other teams are coming back. They're not going to play 750 ball for 162 games. So if you take care of yourself and watch what's going on and just get to 500, anything can happen. That's how I firmly believe about it.
Well, that's right, and that's what you expect will happen. I mean, it's hard to, you know, stay on a roll, and it happens sometimes. The team has
sometimes
a magical year, and they keep going, but there's so many things that can happen. There's injuries. As you said, a guy is hot, now he gets cold. You know, the whole team changes in personnel. Guy's not performing, and all of a sudden, you have a different vibe. It's a little easier to maintain when you have that good of a club and you have depth, but your belief has to be that, hey, we've played our worst baseball up until this point, and we're going to turn this around because we have guys in that room that have done it, and we know what we can do. So I think you said it well, that what our expectation is, we'll worry about ourselves, yeah. and there's no guarantee these other teams are going to continue to play that the way they are, and hopefully we can chip our way back into the race.
They're coming back.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, you know, if you grow tomatoes, I don't care what you do in April and May and June, we're all going to have tomatoes in August. You know, that's the way it works. It comes back, unless some, you know, Tigers 35-5 or some Cincinnati
right.
Reds 70-30 or, you know, the Big Red Machine. You know, things like that happen.
Right.
Seattle 116 games, whatever. Things like that happen. So that's how I feel about it. All right, we'll take a break. I want to talk to you a little bit about that play with Jason Hayward. Running that in the lane, and where Moore was when he threw the ball, and what the rule really is. And that was a very big play in that game, and almost the three-run homer almost happened with Hayward as well. So what a crazy 4 days in Chicago. And also we'll talk a little bit about secondary leads, because we hear this word all the time. Phil Nevin is concerned about it. All third base coaches are concerned about it. I know it's something you teach, but I'm not sure I understand really what it is and how you do it as opposed to just a primary lead. So we need the professor on this. All right, we'll be back with Ron Wotus right after this. All right, nice to have you back with us. Who's running the show? Brian running the show today. Raf is there as well. We're here in the bunker with the professor. Let's start off with the easy one, the secondary lead. And it's huge. I mean, you look at Ron Washington, third base coach, Phil Nevin, Flan, and you've coached third. It's a critical point of what you have to do as a third base coach. Some players do it better than others. Why? What's going on here?
Yeah, well, there's the primary lead, and then there's the secondary lead. The primary lead is how far you get off the base. So let's say you're at first base, and you know you're a base stealer. You want to get as good a primary lead as you can. Off the base as far as you can to get closer to the base. But if you're not stealing, and this comes into play for every player, every time they're on the bases, is how far do you get off the base when the ball is hit? So you want a good effort on a secondary lead, and the best example I can give you is if you're running the bases at second base, your primary lead and you're not a base stealer isn't as important as your secondary lead. Yeah. So you usually take 2 to 3 shuffles off the base, okay, going towards third, so you can get as far as you possibly can. So if that ball's put on in play, you can score. But the other side of it is you obviously can't go so far where the catcher can pick you off.
Oh, we saw
so
that.
You have to time it perfect. So when your right foot is landing towards third base, that last step, the batter puts the ball in play, you time it where you continually run if the ball's hit, or you land on that foot and you break back to the base. And a good secondary lead, if the pitch is not hit, it's a ball or swung and miss, when you land, you're going to run hard back to that base because you have to, because if you don't, they have a chance to pick you off. So that's the effort you want. You want to get as much on your secondary lead as you can, where if the ball's not put in play, they cannot pick you off.
Yeah, it's critical for scoring, though, from
yes,
second base or even going
yes,
first to third. And some do it better than others.
Yeah, you know, a lot of times it's just effort. It's just instinct for the player. Yeah. But you said it right. Every base coach, especially a third base coach, when you have a pitcher up, let's say, and you typically when the pitchers are hitting, someone other than Bumgarner, the outfielder's playing more shallow, right? So you got a guy at second base with two outs. The only way the third base coach can score him is if he gets a great secondary lead and a great jump on the hit. And it just doesn't have to be the pitcher hitting. It could be anybody, a hitter up that doesn't have a lot of power. You have two outs. You want to score that runner on a two-out base hit because you don't want to hold them up with two outs. So you really have to fight to get off that base as far as you can so the third base coach has a chance to score you. And we see plays at the plate. It's a matter of inches. You know, one step can make the difference. So you need to fight to get as much as you can.
You guys work on that a lot in spring training, right?
Not just in spring training. They work on it now.
Do they?
I think, yeah, players go off. You watch batting practice. They go out there with Nev, and they work on their reads at second base.
Yeah.
Of course, they work at every base in spring training and even during the season. But the most critical base, because there's so many decisions to make, is at second base. When there's no outs, fly balls, do I tag? Do I go halfway? You know, getting a good read on a base hit. So all those types of things come into play at second base.
Yeah, it made me think of Jaime Garcia's hit because he's a pitcher. And
right,
Belt was in pretty good position. And the guy hit third. I thought Belt had a shot to get him at the plate.
Yeah, he did. He did, you know. And, you know, he's a first baseman by trade, as we all know. And he's got a good arm. But there's so many little nuances at a position. You know, how quickly you get rid of the ball, how quickly you charge the ball. And those things, obviously, are much easier for a guy that plays that position on an everyday basis.
And Kane got caught. He wasn't where he should have been. The pitcher, again, he became a spectator.
Yeah, as we said earlier. And that happens. You know, it happens in the game every day. And that's why your young listeners out there, you know, if they think... when the ball's hit, I have somewhere to go. Even if it's as simple as a ball's, you know, hit to the shortstop and you're the right fielder, head down towards that first baseline in case there's an overthrow. You're in position to keep that guy from going to third base. Maybe he only on the wild throw gets to second.
One of the craziest rules, I think, is this lane going to first base. You're supposed to run within the lane, but at some point you got to get out of the lane to get to the bag. And Hayward, and you guys were right on top of it. Why don't you explain what happened with Hayward? The call went your way, but I watched it a bunch of times. I said, my goodness, you know, maybe one step, because where Moore was, he couldn't have thrown the first anyway unless Belt got on the other side of the bag.
Right. Well, that's been talked about an awful lot in baseball, that the 3 foot line that you have to run in foul territory as a base runner. You know, they talked about, well, should it be moved over? Should the base be in a different, you know, area so you have a throwing lane? But that play comes up quite a bit. The ball's hit down the first baseline. As a runner, you cannot be running to the left or the infield side of that line.
Okay.
And it's very difficult the closer you get to the base.
Yeah.
Now, if you're running on the grass or your whole body is, you know, both feet are on the inside part of the line on the infield side, and it's a throw, you know, hits the runner or it hinders the fielder in making first baseman in making the play, they're going to call it out. In Chicago's case, I tip my hat to the umpire. It was the right call. He was, you know, right inside that. He was in good position, Hayward. In his last two steps to the base, he veered inside, and his feet were on the inside part of the line. Now, Joe Maddon was arguing the throw was, you know, to the foul side of the base. There's nothing he can do. Well, if he's inside the line, that play is not called, and the throws to the inside part of the base, it's just something the foul side of the base, it's something you deal with. But obviously, if the runner's on the inside and the first baseman has to reach across and not make the play, they're going to call it every time.
So you have to hinder the throw, though. I mean, is that the deal? You have to interfere with
the
play?
Yeah, you have to interfere with it. Yeah, because, you know, if there's no interference, that's what you're told as a catcher. Hey, if he's go ahead and hit him right in the back. You know, if he's in your way,
throw it at him.
And that's when you're going to get the call. Because if there's no interference and the out is made, obviously there's no reason for them to make the call. So you really have to affect the throw. And a lot of times it comes down to umpire's judgment. Did the runner really affect the play at first base?
Well, I haven't heard that since high school. I remember that the coach said, if the guy's in the way, throw it at him.
Yeah.
Just hit him.
Yeah. Well, and if you have no throwing lane, you
yeah,
have nothing
just
else
hit him.
Well, yeah.
Very good. Okay. That's good stuff from the professor. Very good. What do you think of the basket there? And as Samardzija called it, the Easter basket. And it's the first time I ever heard of that because it's kind of a gift. But, you know, you do the ground rules, and, you know, you go out there. You've been in every park imaginable talking ground rules. What do they tell you about the basket?
Well, there's not much they really go over. You know, in Wrigley, they go over the ivy all the time, right?
Okay.
If the ball gets stuck in the ivy, you know, it's dead. Once it's in that ivy, don't reach in there and look for it. You know, you can't let that ball be stuck in the ivy, and, you put your hands up to tell the umpire it's stuck, and then 5 seconds later, you decide to pull it out of there. You can't do that. Now it's in play. If you pull that thing out, the umpire has to go out, and then they say, okay, lodged ball, and then they'll award two bases or whatever the case may be. But the basket, they never really go over it. We know that's a home run. If it's in the basket or beyond the basket, it's a home run. And that basket comes out quite a bit.
Yes.
So it's just amazing to me that a fan was able to lunge all that way and get his glove and which appeared to be beyond the basket and onto the field.
Well, someone did an article on the internet that Ron Wode is talking about the basket in Wrigley, that they've changed the seating in that area where the seats are either higher or lower, and it's easier to make that reach into the basket. And right field it's different, but left field they changed the configuration.
Right. Well, it's interesting, you know, it keeps the fan interference away by having that basket, but I'm not quite sure. There's some days out there in Wrigley when, you know, you shag balls that outfield is very, you know, loud and ruckus out there, you know, yelling at players and all. I think sometimes on those 50-cent beer nights, that basket is there to keep the fans from falling onto the field.
Very good. They did have 10-cent beer night in Cleveland.
Did they?
They started a riot. You know, it was the end of the game. They had a forfeit, you know, and stuff like that. They've had all these things that we could do another show on that. The minor league, you know, we've talked about it. Minor league.
I saw a cow in Arizona on the field.
Come on, how about that?
I don't know if it was a lamb for the third baseman. I saw a cow on the field.
Yeah, it was an actual cow, and they had the cow milking contest.
Okay,
and I forget who won it, but someone who was adept at doing that.
Yeah,
I haven't seen that in a long time.
That's a typical minor league event. I remember in the Midwest we had a lot of that out in the farmland, you know, Wisconsin and places. We had cows on the field.
There's the legend, Gary Hughes.
There is Gary Hughes. Hi, Gary.
The legend. He's here early today. My goodness, what's he doing
no
here?
No BP
so
either.
Really?
What's he doing here so early?
Well, he must have slept around town last night around here. Interesting. Situation. We'll leave it with this one for you. I know you got to get to work. Arroyo, and he's one of your guys. He's one of your infielders. And look, you've been around a long time. You've mentored people. People have probably mentored you. I'll ask you that part of the question. Someone who mentored you as a young man. But what do you say to this kid who's you know, he hit 490 at AAA, and here he's good defensively, and he's in a little bit of a rut now. What do you say to him?
Well, it's tough because everybody wants to help the kid. You know, you have hitting coaches, you have infield coaches, you have other coaches that don't deal with them, you have broadcasters, you have the manager. Everybody wants to offer some advice to the kid, and you know, sometimes just being upbeat and positive, encouraging is the best thing to do than have too many voices in his head. The bottom line is, we like the player. He came up here and did a very good job. He's struggling at the plate. It's not easy coming from the limited experience that he's had. And he has all the talent that he needs to have to be successful in the major leagues. But when you never struggled before and now you have to struggle here at the major league level, and this pitching keeps coming every day, and the pressure to win and to do your job mounts, it's better when you have more experience. You have dealt with that before. So, honestly, keep doing what you're doing. You know, tell them, you know, just be a part of the club. You know, you don't have to carry us offensively. You're playing great defense. You're competing well. Just keep going, and you'll get through this is the important thing. And I know he's had a lot of players and people trying to help him out. Mm-hmm. He has the right approach. But it's much easier said than done
sure.
when you're not hitting the way you want to hit.
Oh, absolutely. A kid who was hitting 490
yeah.
and came up and hit Kershaw and had some big hits on the road trip.
Sure.
On the hit in St. Louis and the hit certainly against the Mets got you guys back going again. So he's had the success. Did anyone mentor you in your career? Anyone sit down with you and try to get you through those times?
Well, I never struggled, Marty, as a hitter, so I don't remember that.
The coaches are now laughing.
Yeah, no, look, we all have people. I actually, you know, the one person that helped me the most in the minor leagues was one of my minor league managers who I had for 3 or 4 years. And it was a big supporter of mine was Tommy Sant.
Yeah.
He coached for the Pirates for a long, long time. He was my manager in Double A. He took me on the club that year. They had other infielders they liked better. He put me in the outfield. And then I had him in Triple A for 3 years. And, you know, again, he was one guy that always said, hey, you're going to be fine. You know, yeah. take you out for some extra BP, relax, just play the game. And, yeah, he was one guy that really helped me. And, you know, one thing I wanted to say back to Arroyo, too,
yeah,
is, you know, when you're this young and he's done a good job up here, there's been a lot of very, very good major league players that come up to the major leagues mm-hmm. in their first go around. You know, don't hit or the way they want to. They go back down to the minor leagues, and they really grow from that experience. You know, the one guy that comes to mind is the other third baseman the Giants had here that was a pretty darn good player in Matt Williams.
Yeah.
You know, I did it several times. So, you know, he keeps battling. He's got the right approach and attitude, so we'll see what happens.
No, McCovey,
yeah.
Davey Concepcion.
Yeah,
Mike Schmidt. Look at Mike Schmidt's first year in the big leagues.
Sure.
You know, I remember that quite well. Very, very good. Our question for today, we have this pool question to have dinner with me at Original Joe's in North Beach. Who's a Giant today who'll hit the first home run for the Giants today? What inning and how many on base? You want to take a shot at that?
Yeah, well, I'm going to go with hopefully he's in the lineup. You gave me the stats. I'm going to go with Justin Ruggiano.
He's
going to be my pick today. And I guess the percentages for us this year have been with the solo shot.
Okay.
And I'm going to go with his second at bat. So let's say it's going to be And I hope it's the third inning with his second at bat if he's in there. But we'll say the fifth inning.
All right, Ruggiano fifth inning solo shot. All right, well, you're in for June.
Ah, perfect.
If Raph picks your name out, you may be able to have dinner.
I love
with
original
me.
Joes.
Okay, all right. Hey, have a great time. It's always a pleasure catching up with you, and we'll see what happens today with the knuckleballer and Cueto. It's going to be a good matchup, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. Well, good to be with you, Marty.
All right, well, thanks. All right, that is the bench coach of the Giants, Ron Wotus. More coming up on the Sports Leader.